You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks.
Hello and welcome to Tom Talks, the talk show where we totally talk Tom Cruise. With me today is a very special guest. He is the former bodyguard for Colorado Rockies mascot Dinger. He also was a tour guide for the Molson Coors Brewing Company, and he is the writer, director, and producer of the cult classic feature film Seclusion. Please welcome to the show my dad, Steve Mudd. Dad, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on Tom Talks.
I always forget that you were a tour guide at Coors. I knew you worked at Coors. I kind of thought you drove a train, but that's some weird misguided childhood memory.
No, that is accurate. As part of my job as a tour guide, I had a commercial driver's license where I drove the tour bus through Golden. I could have up to 40 passengers with that license. So we'd drive around and be like, look at this. And then one summer they had a special pilot where they brought in a trolley car, and I was picked to be one of the drivers of the trolley car. And the trolley car was intended to drive around the city of Golden and provide the deeper historical tour. I was pulled off of the program because they realized having an 18-year-old driving a trolley car around the streets was some sort of an insurance liability.
Major insurance liability.
Yeah. I knew the tour as good or better than anybody else. I probably gave one of the best tours, but driving the trolley was too much of a risk, according to the lawyers.
I don't remember how, I don't know if I've heard the story of how you got the job at Coors Field, how you got the job as a bodyguard for Dinger.
So it was pretty, one of the women that I worked with at Coors at the brewery had applied and had been hired as one of the first guest relations employees for the Rockies. And she talked to me and she's like, oh, you got to come down. You got to come down. And, you know, I put in my application, and I've never seen anything quite like this. I actually went in for an interview. I remember Bob, I can't remember his last name, but I remember going into his office, and he literally had a stack of resumes, like not a little stack, but, you know, maybe 8 to 10 inches high stack of paper with resumes from people who had applied. But, you know, because I knew this woman, I was towards the top of the list. Of course, I was going to school in Wyoming at the time. So in order to stay in contact with him, I was calling him quite a bit. You know, I'd call him and we play phone tag. And because we were playing phone tag, my resume stayed on the top of the list. So I was hired. And I think due to school reasons, I was not present at opening day, like the very first day at Mile High Stadium.
Right.
But was there for the first series, and it was insane. There were, you know, Mile High Stadium was packed, and it was amazing. It was so cool.
Did you ever get to meet any of the other mascots too while you were working with Dinger?
You know, I did do a couple of offsite events with Dinger. And so I met the whatever the Eagle's name is from the Air Force Academy. And it was really funny. We had a little sit down with the Air Force Academy mascot. And Joby was the Rockies mascot actor at the time. And so Joby sat down and actually gave this Eagle a lot of advice on how to be a good mascot. How do you carry the torch? I unfortunately missed. They did have an event at Coors Field where actually all of the mascots from Major League Baseball were there.
Oh, wow.
Like every single one. There was some sort of, I can't remember if it was the All-Star game or something, but all of the mascots were there, but I missed that one. There's two schools of mascots. There's the dopey, loopy, funny mascots like Dinger was, and then the more athletic, crazy mascots, you know, like Rocky from the Nuggets. You know, these guys who were just gymnasts and were just freaking phenomenal at things. So it was funny to see the different schools of thought. Like, these guys would actually sit down and talk about the nuances of being a good mascot, the things you have to do to mascot well.
Well, we should talk some Seclusion too, I suppose, because I'm thinking back on my guests. You're probably the closest to actual movie making of any of my guests thus far. Reflecting on Seclusion, what is the big takeaway from making a movie in your, was it early 30s, late 20s?
You know, I hit the age of 29 and decided I want to do this before I'm 30. I wanted to make the movie. I've been writing scripts for a long time out of that. And I think we shot it the month after my 30th birthday, which was cool. So I turned 30 in May. And so that was part of the impetus for it. I think, you know, when you look at the, oh, what's your advice to filmmakers? Or what's the thing? You know, it's, there's a certain point at which it has to hurt you to not make the movie, right? To want it so bad that it hurts you not to make it. Everybody wants to, like film majors and all that. Okay, yeah, I want to make a movie. But until you don't want to not make a movie, you won't do it. You know, you have to go all in to accomplish that. You know, so I'm certainly proud of that. And my other big advice is surround yourself with people who know what they're doing, because I did not.
Sure.
I had no real experience. I hadn't really been on sets, anything like that. But I surrounded myself with people who did, and you know, they lifted me up and they lifted the production up. And you know, obviously, we didn't win any Oscars. Two and a half stars on Netflix.
That's something.
It is available now if you look for it on the DVD. We're not streaming, but yeah, 2.5 stars there. So I'm proud of that experience. Proud to do that. And so those would be the things that I still think about today. Was just the amazing team that we put together. You know, the work that your mom did, and the work that Rich, my cinematographer, did, and you know, my assistant director, and Haley Garcia, you know, who's still working in the industry, has done some amazing things. You know, it's amazing to be around those people, and just the stubbornness to get something done is something that hopefully I still have a little bit of left in the tank.
As someone who's seen the film like 4 times, why raccoons?
It just seemed funny. It seemed like that was a common animal that you would encounter in the mountains.
Sure.
And it just sort of became funny. And I'd hoped we would be able to catch some raccoons on camera while we were up there. Which, of course, brings me to that scene in Collateral where they shoot 2 coyotes crossing the street.
Sure. I suppose this is Tom Talk, so we should probably talk some Tom also. How familiar would you say you are with Tom Cruise's filmography?
I would say very, very extremely familiar.
Yeah.
Well, I say that not as familiar as you. On a scale of 1 to Connor, I'm probably maybe a 6 or 7.
Okay. Well, what would you say your favorite Tom Cruise film is?
I think from a pure production standpoint and story, you know, I still go back to Jerry Maguire as just one of the best written, sort of, you know, playing on his macho alpha male sort of bull stuff. I don't know if can I curse? I can't remember if I can.
I can censor because it's not live.
Yes. So Jerry Maguire, as far as a character and him, you know, actually acting is tremendous. I mean, you look at his other more serious films, you know, Born on the 4th of July, I think he does a wonderful job. And I honestly love the Mission Impossibles. I love the early Mission Impossibles. Top Gun is phenomenal in so many ways. And after rewatching Collateral, I really like it. I don't know that it's one of his best films. You know, it's not fully Tom, but I liked it a lot. I don't know. I'm probably missing some. Eyes Wide Shut would be another one that comes to mind. I mean, anytime he gets a chance to work with a, you know, top-notch director, I think he has certainly made a point in his career of working with people who know their stuff. And so, you know, Cameron Crowe with Jerry Maguire, I just lost the Eyes Wide Shut guy. Stanley Kubrick with Eyes Wide Shut, Oliver Stone with Born on the 4th of July, you know, the first Mission Impossible with, I forget that director's name, but each of the Mission Impossibles, you know, he's you know, like John Woo, he's found these amazing directors to work with. And I think this one, Collateral, being, you know, Michael Mann, another like top director, you know, stylistically, or at least somebody who's very unique and is going to bring a unique vision that complements Tom Cruise and doesn't. It's not a Tom Cruise movie. It's a Michael Mann film with Tom Cruise in it.
Right. And that's kind of this stage of his career, is it's other people's movies where he kind of fills in that role. Like, because the one right or 2 before this was like Austin Powers. And I was just like, it was the first cameo he had done in like 20 years.
Yeah, and I don't even remember his cameo in that. I certainly love his cameo in Tropic Thunder, but yeah, those are just sort of bite-sized little pieces that I'm not as excited about. Magnolia being another one with that director whose name?
Paul Thomas Anderson.
Paul Thomas Anderson, yeah.
He also, he did Color of Money with Martin Scorsese. Like,
oh, yeah.
He did Far and Away with Ron Howard. War of the Worlds with Steven Spielberg. Yeah. He works with real good, really, really good directors. Less so recently, but back in the early years, definitely. I think once you hit Tropic Thunder, it kind of, because Lions for Lambs was Robert Redford. Still respectable. Terrible film, but a respectable director.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you look at the point of, in the career that he is, you know, I mean, I think there's certainly probably some young directors or action directors that are, you know, more up and coming that he's been working with. I don't even know, honestly, who he's been working with lately, but I did find the hidden connection between The Color of Money and Collateral.
What is that? Isn't Tom Cruise?
Tom Cruise's character's name. He is Vincent in Collateral, and then also Vince in The Color of Money, right? Is that accurate?
Yeah. He plays Vincent Lauria in Color of Money. So, and that's one where he wears his name on his chest that whole film. There are two questions that I ask. Well, I guess I ask all my guests these four questions, but there's two more. What is the most Tom Cruise-y thing that you have ever done?
I've ridden in the back of a cab. I don't know. I'm trying to think of Tom Cruise-y things that get done. And of course, having just watched Collateral, I'm thinking, okay, what does he do in that movie? I've not murdered anyone, but I have, in fact, ridden in a cab for a long time. And, you know, I haven't run down the hall. There was a weird period of my life when I was young where people said I looked like Tom Cruise. So I think there's a possibility I had Tom Cruise type hair at one point. Yeah, I've never jumped on a couch. Never joined a cult.
So just riding in cabs and having decent hair.
That's pretty
Tom Cruise-y.
Pretty Tom Cruise-y, yeah. Yeah. I've got a couple of ex-wives.
Well, the last Tom Cruise question, it's not really a question. It's more of a small mission. I give all of my guests 1 minute to say anything that you could ever want to say to Tom Cruise. In the event that he ever listens to this podcast, I'm going to super cut all of these minutes together so that he has one continuous minute of messages. If you're ready, then your minute starts now.
Hi, Tom. This is Steve. We're putting together a sequel to the film Seclusion. Would love for you to be a part of it. It's actually called Conclusion. And we'll reflect the end of the story, wrapping up everything that we had from the first one. So when you're ready for your next adventure with a relatively new director, give me a call. But seriously, thank you for being Tom. Thank you for what you brought to our culture. Thank you for the great work that you've done. I know you've taken a lot of flack for some of the activities that are maybe outside of what people would expect from a quote-unquote movie star. But I appreciate the work. It's clear from everything we know and read about you that you put in the work and you do the homework and you do the stunts and you do all of that. And that is a lesson, I think, for actors and movie stars, across the board. You can't just phone this in, and you never do. So thank you.
Perfect. You filled a full minute. That's all I ask from my guests, just to fill that 1 minute.
I'm very good at short one to 2 minute videos. I can get a good soundbite in now and then. How old is he now?
Oh God, 50 something.
That can't be, because I'm almost 50 something.
I don't know. Let me check.
We'll have to look this one up. Yeah, because I guess you wonder what the future of Tom is going to be like, right? Like what is he's 58.
58, yeah.
Yeah, that's you look at some of these aging actors and I would love to see, as an addendum to my 1 minute, dear Tom, please look at your second chapter or whatever this is, third. I don't know how many chapters you've had, but you have to figure out what does an aging Tom Cruise, how does Tom Cruise morph into Paul Newman or or a Redford or a Duvall, you know, like how do you take your, the next film seriously? Because at least to me, at a certain point, you got to stop doing the action films and, you know, lean into that aging man role in some way, because at some point it's just not going to be believable that he's Ethan Hunt anymore.
Sure. Because I'd say he's had three chapters thus far, and it looks like he's still in chapter three. In his second chapter, he tried to become more serious. And then in the third chapter, he's lost all seriousness. Because, I mean, starting out, he was like the young 80s guy, hotshot. He'd do fun movies, like campy roles. And then he would, like, what would the turning point even be? The turning point would probably be Far and Away, because he tried to take himself seriously. And then he went into A Few Good Men and The Firm and, like, Jerry Maguire, Eyes Wide Shut. Like, that was all that era. And then he did Minority Report, which was a shift. But then the actual, like, full shift was probably Tropic Thunder. And since Tropic Thunder, he's only done action.
Yeah, A Few Good Men would definitely be another one of his really good films. But yeah, I don't know that you can point to one that has, you know, some sort of dramatic value in the last few years. And I would like to see more of that Tom Cruise if I get a vote.
We actually have a game called Blonde Villains. But first we have a commercial break. So we'll get into a commercial break and we'll be back right after this.
This is Tom Skerritt for the Borgen Project. Each year, nearly 2 million children die from preventable diseases. Each day, 30,000 people die from hunger. 500 each hour are children. The Borgen Project is turning this around. We need your help. To learn more, go to borgenproject.org. That's B-O-R-G-E-N project.org.
Biking in Chicago is more than just a mode of transportation. It's a lifestyle. It's convenient, affordable, and with 13,000 bike racks, parking is never a problem. But with every reward comes a sidecar of risk. In Chicago, over 1,700 cyclists a year are killed or injured in bike accidents involving motor vehicles. Bike safety is simple. First, become familiar with Chicago bike laws. Know your hand signals and when to use them. Love your brain. Get a bike helmet that fits your noggin and deck it out with a headlamp and some reflective gear for riding at night. Bike at least 3 to 4 feet away from parked cars to avoid being struck by a car door being open. Motorists can do their part too by checking their side view mirrors for bike traffic before exiting their vehicle. Most importantly, remember that we're sharing the road. Looking out for both ourselves and each other is the only way to keep Chicago's roads safe, no matter what your wheels look like. For more information on bike safety in Chicago, visit www.chicagobikes.org. This public service announcement was brought to you by Radio DePaul, Chicago's College Connection.
And we are back. You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks. I'm here with my dad, Steve, and we're going to play a game I like to call Blonde Villains. That's, you heard me right. So Collateral, of course, is one of the films where Tom Cruise dyes his hair blonde and is a villain. In fact, this is his only film where he dyes his hair blonde, and it's one of, what, two or three where he's a villain. So what I've done is I've put together a list of at least who I think the 8 best blonde villains from movies and TV, mostly movies. We're going to work together. We're going to figure out who would win in a cage fight, in a fight to the death in a cage, Royal Rumble style. So I'll share my screen. I've got the list here.
Yeah, that's good. And I'm going to put in a conscientious objection here at the beginning.
Okay.
Because his hair is not actually blonde in the film.
What would you call it? Is it white?
It's gray, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely gray and white. But
sure, whatever. I'd say it's blonder than it ever is any other time. And it's not like, because he's not playing an old man, right? It's not like a silver white. It's like a platinum blonde situation.
No, well, and I think in true Michael Mann style, he's trying to take advantage of shooting at night and it's very dark. And so the it's like a dark, icy hair. But okay, I'm ready for the game.
Yeah, okay, blonde villains. So I've put together a list of the 8, for my money, my picks for the best 8 blonde villains from movie and TV. Here is the list, and then we will work to figure out who gets knocked out of the Royal Rumble first and who makes it to the very end. So our eight villains are Ivan Drago from Rocky, Draco Malfoy from Harry Potter, Johnny Lawrence from Karate Kid, Iceman from Top Gun, King Joffrey from Game of Thrones, Prince Charming from Shrek, Ric Flair from WWE, and Mr. Joshua from Lethal Weapon.
So it's just open discussion now?
It's open discussion. Who do you think, if all of them were let loose in a cage at once, who's the first to go?
I'm trying to remember who King Joffrey is in Game of Thrones.
I have links here so I can show you photos if we need them.
Oh, he's a whiny little twit. So from the category of blonde, whiny little twits, King Joffrey is in that category. I would say Johnny Lawrence is kind of a blonde, whiny little twit.
I feel like...
Draco certainly is a blonde, whiny little twit. So based on the whiny little twit theory...
Yeah.
I would maybe take those three off. Like, I don't know that they would go... I don't know how many we get to eliminate in each round.
Well, it's Royal Rumble. It's a constant struggle of fighting. I thought about doing this as a bracket, but seeding these people felt wrong. So I went for the Royal Rumble style.
Prince Charming was the... Let me look at him again.
He's from Shrek 2 specifically.
Oh, he's a whiny little twit also.
Yeah.
Is it true then that blonde villains are whiny little twits?
Not all of them. I'd say that we have a pretty solid division of probably half whiny little twits. I don't know if I'd agree that Johnny Lawrence is a whiny little twit. Because of his... yes, he's whiny, but he's certainly not little. He's so much bigger than Ralph Macchio's character, at least in the initial film. I have not seen Cobra Kai, which is the most recent iteration of Johnny Lawrence.
No,
but
I haven't watched it yet either. Worth noting that the one of the villains, if you don't count Tom Cruise as the villain in Collateral, of course, was Javier Bardem, who does play a blonde villain in
Skyfall.
Is that, was he blonde in that?
Yes. A very interestingly queer-coded villain also. They made him... it was really weird because James Bond has a very mixed history of queer coding its villains. And that was one that was blatant in a bad way, that it felt like it was something they should have grown out of with that character, but it felt very reminiscent of the old school. I forget which movie it is, but I think it's Diamonds Are Forever. But in Diamonds Are Forever, the henchman to the main villain is a gay couple. And they're portrayed so terribly that it's like, it's not even like low key queer coding. It is explicit. Like these characters are partners, and it's so poor. Like it's such bad portrayal that it angered me, but that's besides the point. That's kind of why I left him off of that list, is because I don't like that villain. I think that of the modern Bond villains, Christoph Waltz, really, it's hard to beat him. With Dave Bautista as his henchman, with the metal thumbs, I love it.
Has Tom Cruise portrayed a gay character?
Yes. The highest grossing LGBTQIA plus film of all time, technically, is a Tom Cruise film. Interview with a Vampire, The Vampire Chronicles.
Yes.
Actually, wait, he does dye his hair blonde and is a villain in that movie.
Oh.
So I suppose he has two blonde villain films.
All right. Given all of that, now let's look at Mr. Joshua for a second.
It's Gary Busey.
And he has, yeah, he's freaking nuts. He's totally nuts. He like tortures Mel Gibson, but I think Mel Gibson likes it.
Yeah. That's a pretty fun scene.
Yeah. I was, you know, okay. So based on this list, for sheer physicality, like who could actually beat the crap out of somebody else, I believe that Ivan Drago, probably the biggest actual badass out of that crew. In terms of fighting ability, probably Johnny Lawrence is maybe the best fighter out of that group. Iceman's good, but he's got to be in a plane. Like if you're in a plane battle, you got to have Iceman.
Right.
And he's not that much of a villain. You know, he's just a butthead. Yeah. Joffrey just has power by his position, which isn't good. But Joshua, Mr. Joshua, Gary Busey, is pure on psycho, like unpredictable villain. And, you know, at least for me, Joffrey's somewhat unpredictable too. You know, if you're looking for a good villain, to me, a good villain is an unpredictable villain. Yeah, and that's what, like, Tom Cruise, in Collateral, Tom Cruise, his character is somewhat unpredictable.
Yeah.
You don't quite know what he's going to do. Jamie Foxx doesn't quite know how to handle all of it. And it's only when he wraps his head around what Tom Cruise's aura is or what his plan is, you know, that he's able to shut some of that down and become his own character once he figures that out. So in terms of sheer unpredictability, Mr. Joshua, not quite sure what's going to happen out of that.
I think it's safe to say that at least I think if this is, like, generally speaking, hand-to-hand combat or weaponed combat in a cage, I feel like it's fair to say that King Joffrey's not going to win it, though.
No. And I'm trying to remember Ric Flair. Let me see Rick. I hate to take WWE's Ric Flair off the list. Yeah, I mean, he had a little bit of unpredictability back in the day and a little bit of flair. I still think Dolph Lundgren, I think Ivan Drago could kick his butt.
So I'm gonna put the ones who are dead there. I think we can also agree that Prince Charming out very quickly. I might honestly already. Well, are we letting Draco Malfoy have magic? Would it even matter?
Yeah, I don't feel like he was even that good at magic, was he? I don't even. I'm trying to remember a spell that Draco ever did that was interesting.
I think wasn't he the owner of the Elder Wand or something? He disarmed that one dude, which gave him which is what ended up killing Dumbledore or something. Spoiler alert, huh. I suppose, but also it's Harry Potter.
It's been a long time, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, even Iceman may have a sidearm and could just shoot him.
True, yeah. Because we never see a spell stop a bullet in Harry Potter. So
no.
Draco probably no defense. So right now you're saying that Dolph Lundgren, Ivan Drago of these, that's who you're thinking?
Well, again, it depends on the parameters for the fight. If you're locked in a cage and it's like a fair fight, Ivan's probably going to win. If it's not a fair fight, I think Mr. Joshua is going to pull a razor blade out of his ear or something and could conceivably take you down. But if in a ring, in an organized fight setting, I think Ivan Drago will be able to win, although Johnny Lawrence may have some ninja karate moves.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take out Iceman because Iceman doesn't have an airplane here. They are in a cage. They are in a cage fight.
Yeah. Now, if it's a volleyball game.
Yeah, if it's a volleyball game.
Iceman.
Right?
No question. If it's volleyball, you end up with Iceman versus Ric Flair.
Well, if you had to pick a two-man volleyball team from this, would those be your top two picks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, by far. Well, I mean, I would say Dolph Lundgren without Ivan Drago being one of the top three.
I think that a Johnny Lawrence Prince Charming volleyball team would actually be pretty strong.
I think that would actually, out of this, yeah, Johnny Lawrence Prince Charming, Ivan Drago, and Iceman. If you don't want
Joffrey or Draco.
Yeah, Draco's no good. Mr. Joshua's no good at volleyball. Joffrey's no good at volleyball.
Yeah, Ric Flair probably has some moves, but I don't know. He wouldn't be my top choice.
I could see Ric Flair with volleyball moves, but Dolph's got the height. It is Dolph Lundgren, right? I'm not making that up.
I believe so. Yeah, it looks like Dolph Lundgren. Okay, so the cage match has come down to three professionally trained fighters and one trained killer. Because I think calling Mr. Joshua a trained fighter is way against the point because he's more than that. But, like, does a WWE guy actually know how to fight, I think, is the next question.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think the training that you get in there and just the athleticism that you need to stay in the ring, I would say that counts. I mean,
but enough to beat a champion boxer and a karate champion, though.
Probably not, no. No, I mean, we've seen crossovers from boxing into MMA, things like that. We've not seen a lot of crossovers from WWE into the real fighting world. Maybe a couple of exceptions with, I can't think of any exceptions.
Yeah.
not in the acting world necessarily. There was that one guy whose name escapes me, but yeah.
Okay, yeah. Then Ric Flair will take our fourth place. He does not get on the podium. He stays in fourth place here. I'd say that these three are a tie, and then Iceman lasts slightly longer.
Yeah.
Just because of his military background.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
But of these three...
Yeah, just in terms of sheer ruthlessness, I honestly think Mr. Joshua takes them all out. If he's allowed to have weapons.
I don't even think he needs weapons. If you remember the scene with him and Mel Gibson fighting under the sprinklers, he really gives it to Mel Gibson. The only reason they stop fighting is because the other cops stop it. And Mr. Joshua, he could have won that fight if he hadn't been, I forget if he was electrocuted or kicked off a building or something ridiculous right before it. But
Yeah, it's been a while. I would need to rewatch that film.
That's one I have not seen all of the Lethal Weapons. I've seen the first 2.5 Lethal Weapons, and I got halfway through the third one. I said no more.
Well, you know, I mean, the first Lethal Weapon, of course, was written by Shane Black, who's gone on to direct some interesting films. I just saw his latest one not that long ago, and the way that he pushes those characters to the edge and to the end, the craziness of Mr. Joshua in Lethal Weapon is I think a tribute to good writing. And I think maybe you had some of that as well with Tom Cruise in Collateral, as he's, definitely pushed to the edge as for the brutalness of his character and just the honesty of it. So there's a non sequitur that is a sequitur, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we're in agreement then. Joshua takes the cake there. Honestly, I feel like Johnny Lawrence and Ivan Drago will take each other out almost. I feel like they're very evenly matched.
Yeah.
Johnny Lawrence is just younger, so he'd probably go out first. But
it'd be curious to see them now at whatever their current age is.
Oh.
What is Dolph Lundgren like now versus, because I've seen the Johnny Lawrence, of course, on the Netflix show. But
right. Because was Ivan Drago in the Creed movies? I feel like his son was or something.
Yeah, I missed those.
I haven't even seen Rocky, so
we'll save that for my new podcast. It's called Sylvester Talks.
Oh,
competing directly with Tom Talks, but featuring just the films of Sylvester Stallone, including. So this here's a footnote to Seclusion. Seclusion was produced by a company, or was distributed by a company. Epoch Films and Epoch also had the distribution rights for one of Sylvester Stallone's first films, which was in fact a pornography.
Yeah, The Italian Stallion. We're all familiar.
Yes, I was not before that. I didn't know you would be. But The Italian Stallion was distributed by the same company that distributed the feature film Seclusion.
You're telling me you didn't know who The Italian Stallion was? I know you as a person. You know damn well.
I don't believe
the Italian Stallion was.
That wasn't the original name of that film. Like they renamed that after Rocky came out.
Sure.
Yeah. Go.
How many episodes? You'd have to do 86 episodes if you did Sylvester Talks.
No, that'd be fine. That'd be fine. Go down to the bottom there. Let's see if we can find. See if it's on that list.
Is it A Party at Kitty and Studs?
Yeah, that may be the one. The Party at Kitty and Studs. Yeah.
Yep,
that was the one. Who's the distributor on there?
I don't even know where I would look for that. down here, probably in company credits.
Oh, it's Nels.
What?
Yeah, it would have been under the company. See, go to the Seymour on the company credits.
Yeah.
Also known as The Italian Stallion. Yeah. Cinema Epoch 2007. So if you click on Cinema Epoch, you should then also be able to see Seclusion and the other Samurai Cop, which, and shout out to Greg Hatanaka if he's watching this, who runs Cinema Epoch. He's put out some really interesting films over the years, and
Like Samurai Cop 2, Deadly Vengeance.
There was a lot of questions unanswered from the first Samurai Cop that they had to wrap up. You know, back for Ghost Keeper. Yeah, he's done. I don't even see Seclusion on the list. That's how many films he has right now.
How many? Oh my God, is that based on what's it? The book Choke.
That's a new one. It looks like Greg actually directed that one. So please keep an eye out in your local video store for the film Choke, directed by Gregory Hatnaka, who is a phenomenal person.
Sure.
And a good, not featuring Tom Cruise or anyone from Collateral.
I don't even, what is your movie rated in IMDb stars?
That's a good question. Let's look it up. Let's see where we are now. If you read the reviews, I think the best review of the film on there, at least my favorite review of the film on there, would be this movie is like porn without the porn.
You know,
whoever wrote that, you know, cheers to them. Like that's good writing. Right there.
That's good. Oh,
wow! I've dropped.
You've got 103 reviews. 103 people have reviewed it on IMDb.
That's you know.
It's wow. A little varied. You've got, I mean, 12.6% gave it a 10 out of 10.
Yeah, well, that's me and your mom.
And me. I'm pretty sure I gave it a 10 out of 10, I think.
Yeah, on there.
You've had 51 people not in the U.S. rate your movie.
We were pirated.
Really?
We sold about 4,000 copies of the DVD here in the U.S. And that was to actually Netflix when they were doing DVDs. That was to Virgin Megastore before they went out of business. That was to some other video store that went out of business. Hollywood Video bought like 800 copies. Like it was, we had a little bit of momentum, and then all those companies kind of went bankrupt. And
how do we get you on streaming?
You know, we could figure it out. It probably isn't that hard. At the time, it was just going to be cost prohibitive, right? Because the economic model for filmmakers has changed so much since we were out. Like, I don't know how much money you make per stream now, and is that enough to justify if it costs us, you know, $5,000 or something to upload it somewhere? It probably doesn't cost that much now, but at the time, it probably cost $5,000 or $10,000 just to figure out how to put it on a streaming service because there were no streaming services.
But yeah, that's Tom Talks. That's pretty much I am. Yeah, well, hey, thanks for coming, Steve. We appreciate having you on the show. I like having family on the show. You're the third family member to have been on Tom Talks, and it's always a joy.
I'm hoping that this episode will be rated higher than the other family members, and that I get invited back. But I'm honored to be a part of Tom Talks, and I look forward to having you on Sylvester Talks.
For sure. All right, we're going to go into a bit of a song break. When we come back, we'll get into a synopsis, fast facts, fun facts, and a data breakdown. So please stay tuned after this. Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks. That was Hands of Time by Groove Armada, which is a song featured in the film Collateral, which is the film we're talking about today. It is one of my favorite Tom Cruise films, just because it's so different from a lot of his other ones. We're going to go ahead and get into a synopsis, followed by some fast facts, followed by some fun facts, followed by a data breakdown. Let's get started with that synopsis. This movie is about Max, who is a meticulous Los Angeles cab driver trying to earn enough to start his own limousine business. One of the evening's fares is federal prosecutor Annie Farrell, who works for the U.S. Attorney for the Central District of California. On the drive to her office, they strike up a conversation, and Annie gives Max her business card. Max's next fare is Vincent. Apparently impressed by Max's skill at navigating through traffic, Vincent tells Max that he is in Los Angeles for only one night to complete a real estate deal. Annie offers Max $600 to drive him to several locations. Initially reluctant to violate regulations, Max is eventually persuaded. As Max waits at his first stop, a corpse falls onto the car, and Vincent reveals himself as a hitman. The body is one of his five targets for the evening. He forces Max to hide the body in the trunk and continue driving. At the second stop, Vincent restrains Max's hands to the steering wheel. Max asks a group of young men for help, but two of them rob him and seize Vincent's briefcase. Seeing the men walk away with the briefcase, Vincent deftly shoots them both dead and retrieves the briefcase. He then offers to buy Max a drink at a jazz club. At the club, Vincent engages the owner, Daniel, in conversation. Vincent then reveals Daniel to have been his third target. Max pleads with Vincent to let Daniel go, causing Vincent to offer a compromise, betting Daniel cannot answer a question about where Miles Davis learned music. Daniel states that Davis went to the Juilliard School, seemingly giving a correct answer. Vincent suddenly, unexpectedly shoots Daniel, revealing that Miles Davis dropped out of Juilliard to be mentored by Charlie Parker. Max's boss Lenny, who has been hectoring him over the radio, tells Max that his mother, Ida, called. Learning of Max's nightly visits to the hospital to see his mother, Vincent insists that Max proceeds with the visit. At the hospital, Ida proudly tells Vincent that Max has his own limousine company, revealing that Max has been lying to her. Overwhelmed, Max leaves, stealing Vincent's briefcase, and hurls it onto a freeway where it is destroyed by a passing truck. With the information on his last two targets destroyed, Vincent coerces Max to meet drug lord Felix Reyes Torena to reobtain the information. Max, posing as Vincent, acquires the information, but Felix orders his men to kill Vincent if he does not complete the job. Max heads with Vincent to a nightclub seeking the next target, Peter Lim. Narcotics detective Ray Fanning uncovers a connection between the three victims and reports his finding to FBI agent Frank Pedrosa. Pedrosa identifies the victims as witnesses in a federal grand jury indicting Reyes Torena the following day. At the nightclub, Vincent kills Felix's hitmen and his bodyguards. Fanning rescues Max and smuggles him outside, but Vincent fatally shoots him and coerces Max back into the cab. Following their getaway, the two trade insulting summaries of each other's personalities and choices in life. After a heated exchange, Max deliberately crashes the cab, but they both survive, and Vincent escapes. A police officer arrives. Seeing the corpse in the trunk, he tries to arrest Max. However, Max notices Vincent's open laptop, revealing that his final target is Annie. He overpowers the police officer, takes his gun, and rushes towards Annie's office building. Stealing a bystander's phone, Max uses Annie's business card to call her and warn her. She's incredulous until Max reveals details about Vincent's previous victims, urging her to call 911. Vincent steals the security guard's gun and uses a fire axe to cut power and telephone lines on Annie's floor. Vincent finds Annie, but is shot and wounded by Max, who escapes with Annie on foot. Vincent pursues the pair onto a metro rail train. Cornered on the train, Max engages Vincent in a sudden shootout. Both men empty their handguns at each other. Vincent, fatally wounded, slumps into a seat, repeating a story about a man dying unnoticed on a metro train. Max and Annie get off at the next station in the dawn of a new day. This is a really fun one. Because Tom Cruise is the villain. Tom Cruise plays the hijacker of the cab, the hitman, which isn't a role that we get to see him in a lot. It's also one of several films that is kind of an ode to transit in a way. Most of the film takes place in a taxi cab between two locations. The final battle is on a train, which there's really something beautiful about the city nightlife in transit, right? So these people going about their business as they would any other night, and something goes terribly wrong. And it's just a phenomenal film. It's one of the earliest digital films, so it was recorded almost entirely digitally. So they got to play with a lot darker sets and a lot darker lighting. So having the entire film take place in one night really shows in its cinematography. It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous film. Let's go into some fast facts here. It was directed by one Michael Mann, who also directed Last of the Mohicans, Manhunter, and The Insider. It was written by Stuart Beatty, who also wrote, you know, G.I. Joe, Rise of Cobra, and one of the Pirates of the Caribbean films. He was featured as a writer on one of those. But, you know, nothing too spectacular for the writer. I believe the story was inspired by a cab ride he actually took, not one where, you know, he hijacked the taxi, but he had the idea of a hitman taking the same taxi to different locations while in a cab. The cast is phenomenal for this film. Obviously, Vincent is Tom Cruise, but Max is played by Jamie Foxx, you know, from Ray, Django Unchained. Jamie Foxx, who's in all sorts of stuff and is a phenomenal actor. I think he's my favorite in Baby Driver. That's my favorite Jamie Foxx role. And he really, he brings a real authenticity to this role. He trained as a taxi driver in order to prepare. He actually like would drive taxi routes, and the way he emotes in this film definitely showcases a great humanity. Annie is played by Jada Pinkett Smith, who you would know from Matrix Reloaded and Madagascar and Scream 2. She was in Scream 2. She plays Gloria in the Madagascar series. That's how I most knew her. Fanning, the detective, is played by Mark Ruffalo. Again, like, these people are so big, I don't need to tell you what they're in. If you don't know Mark Ruffalo, he's the Hulk in the Avengers. He's also in the Now You See Me series and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Spotlight. He's a phenomenal actor. If you don't know Mark Ruffalo, it's ridiculous. Felix is played by Javier Bardem from Skyfall, No Country for Old Men. Yeah, that actor. Jason Statham has a cameo in this movie. Like, not a speaking role. He's just a dude at the train station, I believe. Then there's a few smaller actors. Richard Widener is played by Peter Berg, who's in like Chicago Hope and Lone Survivor. Pedrosa is played by Bruce McGill, who is in Time Cop and Lincoln and Animal House and Law Abiding Citizen. Ida, Max's mom, is played by Irma P. Hall, who is in The Lady Killers and Nothing to Lose. So yeah, the cast of this movie is really phenomenal. The acting really carries this piece on the whole. So we'll go into some fun facts now. Michael Mann thought that the key characteristic for Vincent as a character was his ability to get into a place and leave without being noticed. And so in order to prepare for that quality of the character, Tom Cruise made FedEx deliveries in a crowded Los Angeles market without getting recognized. His whole goal was to go in and get out without getting recognized. And that's how he prepared, which feels a little ridiculous to me. He's done some crazy stuff to prepare for roles, you know, like halo jumping and whatnot. But, you know, how did FedEx agree to that is part of my concern. Tom Cruise also trained for 3 months in firearms with the LAPD. And his instructors all said that he is phenomenal at pretty much anything athletic, including shooting. So he trained very hard for this role. A bunch of people were offered the roles of Vincent and Max before they landed on Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise. Edward Norton was offered both of the roles. I know Johnny Depp was considered, John Travolta was considered. So I like the combination that they ended up with because it gave both of them a role that they really hadn't had before. Because Jamie Foxx is kind of used to playing either the darker heroes or the villains, right? In Django Unchained, he becomes a hitman. In Amazing Spider-Man, he's Electro, right? He goes from goofy to villain. In Dreamgirls, he plays kind of the skeezy producer. So it's good to see him in kind of the straight man role, kind of like the, you know, not the bad guy. And Tom Cruise is the opposite. Tom Cruise is always the big action hero. And in this movie, they dye his hair this silvery blonde and, you know, make him a hitman. So I think it's good contrast to the rest of his films. I mentioned in an earlier episode that this was kind of a transitional film for Tom, in that it's within a period of four films that are all generally considered some of his best movies without being his classics, right? Like, this isn't his Risky Business or Rain Man phase. This is his doing good films and not compromising his action talent. Last Samurai, Collateral, War of the Worlds, and Mission Impossible 3. They all have this phenomenal dramatic quality to them without compromising their action status, because they're all very action-packed, very exciting films. Other fun facts, director Michael Mann actually came from a family of cabbies. His father was a cabbie. His uncle is a cabbie, and his grandfather actually owned a taxi company in New York. And the last fun fact, Mark Ruffalo is 1 month older than Jamie Foxx. That one has very little to do with the movie. I just thought it was fascinating when I found that out. They're born, I believe, exactly 1 month apart, give or take a few days. So, but, you know, that's interesting to me. Let's go into some data breakdown. As you know, I rate each movie on scales of enjoyment, engagement, quality, iconography, and the Tom Cruise factor. For this one, you know, it was pretty good in a lot of the categories. I enjoyed it very much, about a 16. Engagement and quality were both at a 15 for me. Iconography, this movie's not very iconic. Nobody really remembers Collateral, which is disappointing because it is a genuinely enjoyable film. Tom Cruise factors, it's at an 18. He is a hitman. He's, you know, taking charge, shooting people. He's got this charisma about him, but also this, you know, ghastliness because he's, you know, pale and blonde and trying to hide in crowds. So the Tom Cruise factor is an 18, which is one of the highest non-Mission Impossible films in the Tom Cruise factor. I think there's only one other film that hits 18 that is not a series, and that's Edge of Tomorrow, which is very Tom Cruisey. So it has the same Tom Cruisiness as Edge of Tomorrow. It brings it to a meta score of 73. So it's about the same as last week. Last week we had the Last Samurai at a 72. This week, 73. That's it for Collateral. What I'm going to do now, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about the data for next week's movie. So next week, I'm going to try to have two episodes because we are participating in the Rock the Clock Radio Challenge. There's going to be a 48-hour radio broadcast by Radio DePaul where we're going to try raise money for Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital with Demonthon at DePaul. So definitely give it a listen. That'll be the weekend of the 5th, 6th, and 7th of February. There'll be 48 hours straight of broadcasting, and they'll be raising money the whole time. Make sure to listen in for Rock the Clock and donate then. I will be hosting a Rock the Clock special, I believe, at 3 in the morning on Saturday. Because it is my War of the Worlds episode, I will be performing the radio play version of War of the Worlds. So I'm going to go into my data for War of the Worlds because you're going to get a synopsis next week. So let me tell you a little bit about how much I enjoyed that film, about the same as the last two, honestly. Enjoyment was a 12, quality up to 17. It was a lot more iconic than Collateral, so iconography is a little higher. And I give it a 70 out of 100 because it is another really enjoyable film about aliens and the, you know, end of the world and all that kind of fun stuff. It's a phenomenal sci-fi. It is one of his couple, quote-unquote, independent sci-fi films where it's out of a series, it's a little different. Same with Edge of Tomorrow and Minority Report. There are films that are standalone sci-fi classics, and War of the Worlds is one of them. I believe it is a remake from the old movie, and of course the 1930s radio play, which I will be putting on. But yeah, overall, it's a good film, and since I'm not going to get to tell you the data breakdown next week, I'll tell it to you now. Other than that, I believe we're just about out of time. So, as always, stay gold, Pony Boy.